From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino, sitting in for A. Martinez, and we hope you're having a great holiday week so far. Coming up later in today's show, we'll hitch a ride with a Los Angeles police officer to find out how increasing speed limits can actually help slow traffic down. Confusing, I know, but just bear with us. We'll explain. First, though, we're going to talk about the tragic news on the U.S. border over the weekend. An 8-year-old boy from Guatemala died while U.S. immigration authorities had him in custody. It's the second death in less than 3 weeks of a child in detention. Earlier this month, a 7-year-old girl also died in immigration custody. And that leads us to the story of how immigrants are now being held at the southern U.S. border. Central American migrants waiting to seek asylum in the U.S. are in for an even longer wait in Mexico now. The Trump administration wants them to stay there while their claims are processed. Among these thousands of hopeful asylum seekers are families with young children. As part of our California Dream series, KPCC's Leslie Beristain Rojas has this snapshot.
The migrant shelter that's been set up at the old El Barretal nightclub on the outskirts of Tijuana is a sprawling sea of tents. Men talk and play cards around boomboxes blasting tunes. Women shake out blankets and fold donated clothes. And everywhere you see children. Not far from the entrance, 3-year-old Montserrat plays with donated toys in the tent that she, her 4 siblings, and their parents call home. She puts a toy pot on a tiny plastic stove. I ask her what she's going to cook.
¿Qué vas a cocinar?
Comida.
Food, she says. Montserrat's mom, Rosa Reyes, smiles a tired smile and shakes her head. Reyes and her husband left Honduras October 13th with their 5 kids. They range in age from 10 years to 10 months. The youngest ones rode in a stroller. The 2 oldest, 8-year-old Ruth and 10-year-old Genesis, came all the way on foot.
Mucho caminar.
That's Ruth. She talks about lots of walking, getting sunburned. You can still see the blotches where her skin peeled. Reyes says the kids would tell her, "Mom, we don't want to walk. Let's go home." But Reyes says they can't go back. She hasn't told the kids exactly why. Reyes tells about being extorted and threatened by a criminal gang back in San Pedro Sula. The couple had a small business, a produce stand. After countless shakedowns, they ran out of money. They were given a deadline to pay up. If not, they were told one of the kids would turn up dead. So they left. They have no family in the U.S. and no idea where they would live. But a few friends on Facebook suggested Los Angeles, and that has fueled her dreams. Los Angeles, the angels come from God, she says. It must be beautiful. But it's harder convincing the kids. I asked Ruth if she wants to go to the U.S.
No.
What does she want to do?
Regresarlos para Honduras.
Then Ruth sees the disappointed look on Mom's face. She fidgets.
Quiero seguir.
She changes her tune. I want to keep going, she says. Uncertainty and frustration among the children and their parents are pretty much the norm in the camp. Ana Elia Valdez is here with Save the Children, an international NGO that has a tent set up at El Barretal. She says the kids have a scrambled mix of emotions.
De repente los miras como tristes, de repente los miras contentos.
Valdez says they can be sad, excited, restless, angry. She and other aid workers help the kids work through their emotions through art and play. Near her, a group plays Loteria, the Mexican game of chance. Most people at El Barretal have taken a number, hoping they can present themselves to U.S. officials. But now, even if they get an interview, it's likely they'll have to wait in Mexico while their claims are processed, and there are no guarantees. Many still have their American dream, Valdez says, but they have no idea what will happen to them. Some are giving up. I meet Maria Santos and her 9-year-old daughter, Ashley, across town in an unofficial tent city that sprung up by the old shelter near the border fence. Santos looks exhausted as she sits outside her tent. There are piles of trash. You can hear people coughing. She can't imagine going further. Santos says they aren't sure what they'll do, but her husband and older son have found work here in Tijuana in construction. They no longer see the U.S. as an option. Neither does 9-year-old Asli.
Como no lo dejan pasar, lo vamos a quedar aquí.
Since they won't let us in, she says, we'll stay in Mexico. Her mom agrees. If they can find a place to live, they'll make a new home here. In Tijuana, I'm Leslie Beristain Rojas.
We turn now to local law enforcement. Last month's midterm elections saw a little-known former lieutenant elected as L.A. County Sheriff. Alex Villanueva has been on the job a little more than 3 weeks now, and he's already made some big changes. He's gotten rid of almost all the department's top leaders and transferred two advisors who were tasked with making sure deputies follow the Constitution. For a closer look at the new sheriff on day 23, we turn to KPCC's Frank Stoltz. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning.
So what would you say is Villanueva's biggest move so far?
By far, it's his decision to remove so many top leaders so quickly. The undersheriff, 4 assistant sheriffs, 8 of 12 chiefs. That's a huge loss of recent institutional memory. Contrast this with the new LAPD chief, Michael Moore, who was appointed in June. He kept the entire command staff and only recently removed one of his assistant chiefs for sexual misconduct.
So who has Villanueva named to replace all those senior officials?
You know, we don't have the entire list. He has appointed a lieutenant 3 ranks up to be one of the 12 chiefs. Don't know which division she'll lead. Promoted a captain who oversaw 1 patrol station, 3 ranks to assistant chief overseeing patrols throughout the county at dozens of stations. He's replaced a guy who had been in the top command for a decade. And he was a commander when he left the department 2 years ago for medical reasons, and he'll be the number 2. And this is also significant. Sheriff Villanueva has asked about 500 lieutenants, captains, and commanders to essentially reapply for their jobs. Yeah, that's a lot of people. He says he'll use this exercise to decide where to put people or to remove them entirely. That is already the biggest shakeup at the top of the nation's largest sheriff's agency by far, and it could get larger.
Do we know how he picked all these people that he got rid of?
Well, his spokesman says Villanueva is fulfilling a campaign promise to get rid of corruption at the top. He says some of those who were ousted had connections to corrupt former Sheriff Baca and his undersheriff. And the spokesman says the sheriff wanted to bring in his own team. That's very common, of course. Some believe there's another factor at play here, though. Villanueva felt deeply wronged by the department before being elected sheriff. He had sued supervisors and the department in 2005, accusing them of not promoting him because he's Latino and because he had been critical of supervisors about the corruption. Villanueva says he has a committee helping him look at managers' performance and decide whether to keep people, that there's no grudge list. But in the end, it's the sheriff who has the final say on appointing the department's 80 captains, 30 or so commanders, 12 chiefs, 4 assistant chiefs, and a partridge in a pear tree. But you get the idea, the top command of the department.
I'm talking with KPCC's Frank Stoltz about the first 3 weeks of Alex Villanueva's tenure as the new sheriff of L.A. County. And Frank, these personnel moves that we've been talking about, they're not the only thing that Villanueva has done, right?
That's right. He's acted on a couple of hot-button issues. For one, he shut down the I-5 freeway patrol that the L.A. Times reported was possibly engaged in racial profiling. That caught a lot of attention during the campaign. He says the department is reviewing whether to further restrict cooperation with ICE in the jails. Under the so-called state sanctuary laws, local police can turn unauthorized immigrants over for possible deportation if they've served time for a long list of crimes. Villanueva says the department is deciding whether to refuse to turn people over for some of those crimes on that list. So expand the list of the folks that they wouldn't turn over to ICE. And by the way, the sheriff also apparently has formed a committee to review recruiting and hiring to address a severe deputy shortage that has resulted in lots of mandatory overtime. Kind of a boring issue, but, deputy shortage, but it's a huge issue at the department.
He's also come up with a plan for how to handle body cameras, right?
Yeah, late last week, the department said he'd figured out how to outfit a little over 5,000 deputies for just $13 million a year. Former Sheriff Jim McDonald had said it would cost $55 million a year.
It's a big difference.
Big difference. And a lot of it is in the staffing. He doesn't want to hire more than 200 people to do the job like Sheriff McDonald wanted to do. The department hasn't provided details, but Villanueva told us during the campaign that he thought he could save money also by decentralizing data storage and moving away from 24/7 recording. He says he wants to put cameras on deputies sometime next year. The LA Sheriff's Department is one of the last police agencies in the country not to have deployed body cams.
Has Villanueva made any specific proposals about recruiting?
You know, as a matter of fact, he has. He said he wants more deputies with college education, and he said he wants to hire more from minority and low-income neighborhoods that the department patrols. But the reality is there's a nationwide shortage of law enforcement officers, so there's a lot of competition. And the sheriff's department starts people out at the jails as jail guards, so most people want to be cops on the streets. They don't want to spend their first 2 years as a jail guard, so they often apply elsewhere.
Finally, Frank, as you've reported, Sheriff Villanueva will also have some decisions to make regarding guidelines for deputy discipline, right?
Yes. The guidelines had been toughened after the jail violence scandal under Sheriff Baca. County Commission has ruled that the department shouldn't have adopted the new guidelines without first consulting with the deputies union. It ordered the department to revert to less stringent guidelines that were in place in 2012 and discuss the way forward with the union. So that'll be a big issue for Villanueva. Will he want to put in those tougher restrictions back in or not?
That's KPCC's Frank Stoltz filling us in on the very busy first 3 weeks of Alex Villanueva's time as the new sheriff of LA County. Thanks, Frank.
Thank you.
Looking ahead on Take Two, what happens if LAUSD teachers go on strike? There's an impasse between the LA Unified School District and the teachers' union, and if it's not resolved, educators could walk out starting January 10th. We'd like to speak with parents, teachers, administrators, anyone who could be affected. We want to hear from you. What questions do you have? What are you most concerned about? And if you're a parent with a student in LA Unified, what's your plan for your own child? We'll be tackling these questions on an upcoming segment. So please drop us a line and let us know what you think. Tweet us at Take2. And coming up on today's show, we hear a lot about the battles in LA neighborhoods over where to put housing for the homeless. What we don't hear that often, what these arguments mean for the people who are struggling with homelessness. Well, KPCC heard from one such woman. She wrote us an open letter and will share what she had to say. Plus, starting in the new year, LA cops will finally be able to crack down on speeding in many parts of the city where they've kind of had their hands tied for years. That's thanks to speed limit increases. It's a little bit confusing, but we'll explain how that works when Take Two returns. We'll be back in just a minute. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino sitting in for A. Martinez. Kiana K. Scott has been without a home for a decade, and she says she's faced a lot of stigma because of it.
I've been spit on and called names for wanting to feed my daughters.
Scott says that struggling to get by sometimes meant she had to take desperate measures.
I've snuck and eaten leftovers off the plates of patrons who ate at the restaurants I worked in.
These words are part of an open letter she wrote to people who oppose building shelters for homeless people in their neighborhoods, or NIMBYs, an acronym for Not In My Backyard. Scott emailed us this letter after reading one of our recent stories about residents objecting to a planned shelter in Sherman Oaks. KPCC reporter Jill Replogel recently met Scott, and she's here to tell us more about her story. Hey, Jill.
Hi, Megan.
So tell us a little bit more about Scott's background. How did she first become homeless?
Well, as she was approaching adulthood, she was living in a group home for foster children in the LA area. And she says when she turned 18, she was told she'd have to move into her own apartment. And here's how she explained that time.
I had no skills. I didn't know about credit. I didn't know how to get an apartment. No one prepared me for that moment. I had 6 months to figure it out.
So at 18, Scott did get an apartment, and she said she was working two jobs at the time, but she didn't know anything about managing money. You know, she was really young. She quickly racked up thousands of dollars worth of debt and ended up getting evicted.
Once I got evicted, it was on my credit. I couldn't get another place. No one was willing to even give me a chance or even hear how it happened.
And after that, she ended up homeless. She told me she slept in shelters on the street. She's couch surfed. She slept in her car. She slept in friends' cars. It's a pretty typical rotation for a lot of people experiencing homelessness.
And where is she living now?
So right now, she lives with her five-year-old daughter in a transitional shelter for women and children in L.A. I visited her last month. And at the time, at least, she was there with seven other families. And she told me she found the place on Google. And when she first called, they didn't have space. But 2 weeks later, they called her for an interview. And she and her daughter moved in soon afterwards. And they've been there since January 2017. Scott, by the way, also has an older daughter who lives with her grandparents.
And what motivated her to write this letter to NIMBYs, those people who opposed housing for homeless in the neighborhood?
She said she was at work one day. She has a full-time job with the county, yes, while homeless.
Wow.
Yeah. And she stumbled across an article written by one of my colleagues. It was about Sherman Oaks residents protesting proposed sites for an emergency shelter and permanent supportive housing for the homeless. And in the article, one resident posed an extreme alternative to housing the homeless. He suggested building a reservation for homeless people in the desert, akin to an internment camp. And Scott says she cried when she read that. And she decided to put her feelings into a letter. She's been working with a writing coach at the shelter for almost a year. Here's Scott reading excerpts from that letter.
Dear NIMBYs, my name is Kiana Kay, and I'm not welcome in your backyard. I am 29 years old. I have two children, ages 5 and 9. I am a student at Penn State World Campus. I work full-time, and I have been chronically homeless for the last 10 years. If you are wondering how someone like me could spend her entire adulthood homeless, it's because I grew up in foster care. I aged out of the foster care system at 18. I was a high school dropout with no skills, and I was expected to care for myself after never having had to do it. Where you had a mother, father, aunts, uncles, or grandparents, I had no one. There was no one to ensure that I went to school, no one to take me to the grocery store and teach me how to shop for food, no one to explain how to fill out a job application or to teach me how to apply for an apartment. I've spent the last 10 years trying to figure it out, and because of that, you declare I have no right to live in your backyard. I'm not welcome in your backyard because local shelters are overpopulated and I had to sleep on the street. I'm not welcome in your backyard because I went my entire life being misdiagnosed with behavioral disorders and turned to drugs to self-medicate. Here are some questions for you. How could I have forced the LA County courts to make sure my foster families taught me life skills? How can I force someone to give me a place to live when, while working full-time, I don't make half the rent in even the worst neighborhoods in my city? What you're saying is that the homeless are not people and that we are not worthy of your compassion. Being able to yell, "Not in my backyard," is a luxury. After you're done, you return to your home where you can open your fridge and fix yourself something to eat or take a warm shower and forget all about what you're protesting. Through all of this, here's something you probably didn't know. I maintain hope. Hope that one day things would get better. Hope that one day I would get the help that I so desperately needed. Hope carried me forward. I got a Section 8 voucher that provides me rental subsidy, but guess what? I'm still not welcome in your backyard. You turn your nose up at my voucher, you dissect my life, scrutinize the credibility of my story, then you deny me access to fair, affordable housing. And why? Because you didn't like looking the other way when you saw me on the street? Because you were repulsed by my tent? Because I was aesthetically unpleasing? Or is it simply because I make you uncomfortable? Your discomfort is enough to disqualify me from the American dream.
Wow, what really strikes me about her story is just how few resources she had when she aged out of the foster care system. Is that a common story that you hear of children that have come out of the foster system?
Yeah, Scott's story is not unique. Several studies have found that 1 in 4 foster youth end up on the streets. There is, you know, a state law that changed in 2012 that allow youth to remain in foster care until age 21. It's yet to be seen how much of a difference that has made in those homelessness statistics.
And how is Kiana Kay doing now, Jill?
Well, she recently emailed me to tell me that she did find an apartment that would accept her Section 8 voucher. And if all goes well, she'll move in January.
Oh, great. Thanks, Jill. You can read Kiana K. Scott's entire letter on our website, laist.com. That's laist.com. Thanks, Jill.
You're welcome.
Turning now to our roadways, starting New Year's Day, speed limits will go up on more than 100 miles of LA streets. That's because of a state law that requires up-to-date traffic surveys that accurately reflect real-world driving conditions. It's only when that happens that police can use laser and radar guns to enforce speed limits. Officials say that raising speeds can actually help with the city's goal of decreasing traffic crashes. To find out more, A. Martinez rode along with LAPD Lieutenant Dave Ferry last week for an up-close look at speed limit enforcement in action.
All right, so we're on our way to Chandler Boulevard. This is an area that was recently surveyed by the LA Department of Transportation. They did a traffic and engineering survey there. And in order for the LAPD to use electronic devices, radar or laser, to enforce speed there, the speed limit has to be increased from 35 miles an hour to 40 miles an hour.
And so let me ask you this, because when all of this first was brought up, people were very confused. They're saying, like, wait a second, you're raising speed limits to make the roads safer. Isn't that a little backward? So explain how, in concept, this works.
All right. So when it comes down to it, if a roadway doesn't have an engineering and traffic survey, like many of the roadways in the city of Los Angeles over the last 10 years, we lost our ability as police officers to enforce speeds on about 85% of our roadways, which means we as a department weren't there enforcing speed. So speed slowly starts to creep up on those roadways because no one's getting a ticket. They don't see police officers there. There's no enforcement. So here it is in a nutshell, and this is what a lot of people have a hard time understanding, and I don't blame them. It's not, it doesn't come naturally. If we have a posted 35 that we've had no enforcement on, no police presence on, and people are now driving 50, 52, 55 miles an hour on it, and there's no one there to stop them, and there's no one there to give them a ticket. When it becomes a posted 40, and there's a motor officer there doing enforcement, people start doing 40 in a 40 instead of 55 in a 35.
Now, just to make it clear, when it comes to these surveys that the Department of Transportation is doing, why is it important for them to do these surveys to allow for these speed limit increases?
Los Angeles Department of Transportation does the engineering and traffic surveys and decides the posted speed because they're not doing the enforcement. They're doing those surveys consistent with California law that protects the community against potential police abuse of issuing citations on roadways with artificially low posted speed limits. They look at what people are driving there right now. And if people are driving on that street at speeds that are inconsistent with a 35 mile an hour zone, faster or slower, then in order to certify the survey so that we can do traffic enforcement there, they have to alter the speed limit to make it more realistic for what people are traveling there.
So we're on Chandler in the valley
now.
Chandler
Boulevard, right. We're approaching Hazeltine right now. Hazeltine's one major east of Van Nuys Boulevard. So this is a fairly typical thoroughfare here. There's it's residential, as you can see on both sides of the street. We have single family residences, we have sidewalks, you'll have kids walking to school. This is a posted 35 mile an hour zone, as you can see the posted speed limit sign right there. So basically I'm going to pull over, we're going to see what's happening here, and understanding that come January 1st, the city council has authorized already this posted speed to go from 35 miles an hour to 40 miles an hour. When that happens, and when the signs are changed, then I can come back here with this very device or an even better device.
So that's just a speed radar gun, speed gun?
Yeah. 45, 46.
Wow, that guy was going 46 miles an hour.
46, right there. And they're all, you know.
Oh, that Mustang was going.
Yeah, 55.
Yeah, 55 miles an hour on that Mustang, wow.
But, again, so it's posted 35.
Yeah.
They're going 55. I've been here, what, how many seconds?
2 seconds.
There somebody goes 55 miles an hour, 20 miles an hour over the speed limit, but I can't enforce it. Now, if that sign said 40 miles an hour right now, that would be 15 miles an hour over the speed limit. I'd go pull that person over, issue them a citation. Everyone also driving down the street here is going to see me conducting enforcement here. The folks will realize, you know, as
that's a big part of it, isn't it, right? Because they'll see you doing your job here, and they'll realize, oh, things have changed here somehow.
What I've found in the time that I was a motorcycle officer and doing traffic enforcement is that when I am out there writing somebody a speeding ticket, all the traffic around me starts to slow down, starts driving more reasonably. Are they thinking about traffic safety? Perhaps. Are they thinking about, wow, I'm really glad that's not me getting the ticket? Perhaps. I don't know. But what I know is that it does seem to change the environment. One of my motorcycle officers, he's setting up right now at a place that has a current speed survey. So we'll go over there. I'm going to show you how we do our enforcement, what that officer's doing. And you can see the impact it has on the area. We'll just kind of pull in and tuck in. And as that officer does get a violation and go out there, see how the other traffic starts to react.
Okay.
See how the traffic's moving before the officer gets the violation. When the officer does go out there, pull somebody over. Let's take a look. So now you can see the officers.
Yeah.
They're just set up there. What do you notice about the cars on this street, by and large? It's the same two lanes. We were just on Chandler. Two lanes in each direction. Two lanes in each direction.
Yeah.
About the same width.
Yeah.
We've been on the street.
They're not as fast.
Why is that?
Yeah. Well, that's
we're
because
here,
you're
we're
here, right?
We're here on a regular basis. This is a surveyed street. This is a street that we will go and do regular traffic enforcement on.
Oh, I see some lights up ahead.
Yeah, so do I. So if you noticed it, do you think anyone else around here driving might notice
it? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, you know, this is, you know, that is in part what I'm saying.
I would be minding my P's and Q's if I saw that. So, officer, what's the one thing you would want people to have in mind when they're out driving LA streets?
That they're operating a vehicle that's 3,000 to 4,000 pounds or more. The operation of that vehicle, their life depends on it. And the lives of other people, loved ones, also depend on it. Driving is one of the most serious things anyone can do in their normal day. It's one of the most dangerous things people can do in their normal day. When you're driving, think about driving. Think about traffic safety.
And that all these signs here are not suggestions.
These signs are here to let you know what is safe so that you can get from point A to point B, on these roadways as safely as possible.
Well, Lieutenant Dave Ferry, thank you very much for having us out here in the valley in your car and showing us around. That was very, very eye-opening.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for raising awareness regarding this traffic safety issue.
Coming up next on Take Two, you like all that gourmet Italian food we enjoy these days? You know, not the red sauce and garlic bread checkered tablecloth fare of the past. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, things have come a long way, and we have a legendary Santa Monica restaurant to thank for a lot of that, a restaurant which is closing its doors this New Year's Eve after almost 50 years in business. We will remember Valentino and its pioneering owner in just a minute. Plus, I know you're looking for some tips on how to spend your valuable holiday couch time. We got that when Take Two returns. We are back with Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino in for A. Martinez. At the end of the year, the Santa Monica restaurant Valentino is closing. Even if you've never heard of Valentino, the Italian restaurant and its owner, Piero Selvaggio, have probably changed your life. Here's how. Walk down a grocery store aisle and you'll find aged balsamic vinegar, buffalo mozzarella cheese, arugula, radicchio, extra virgin olive oil, and fine Italian wines. And that is because of Selvaggio. But don't take our word for it. Even the late LA Times food critic Jonathan Gold said you can't underestimate his importance to the way we eat. To mark the end of this era, let's listen back to KPCC's John Raby taking a long lunch with Selvaggio at Valentino.
What is that you're featuring?
No, I want to say that in Italian. You do okay. The talking.
I go back to the kitchen.
What were you eating at home in Italy growing up?
Mama's food. Pasta with ragu, the rice balls fried, so very heavy. On Sunday, we had a big stew with sausages. So heavy, robust food and lots of pasta because pasta in the South is cheap and is our staple. Mama's food. I learned about Italian food because I'm a little immigrant that came to be in this business by mistake. I wanted to be a journalist. I ended up being a restaurateur. The reason I had the restaurant was because I never worked out to be a journalist, and I always worked supporting myself in the restaurant business. And one day with a friend, we opened a restaurant. We became very popular because the Los Angeles Times wrote very nice things about us. We suddenly got flooded with people.
1973, this is when you were doing the red sauce Italian or when yes. You had started to do... Okay, this is your basic mama's Italian.
The partner that I had was another cook that had learned the Neapolitan way of things, which means heavy, robust, of the southern Italian food that the immigrants brought here. So it was what they knew about Italian food then. You know, the famous thing was garlic, checker, tablecloths, heavy tomato everywhere, etc., etc.
Which is, for Americans, it's really great comfort food.
And I love it, and I still have my veal parmigiana, and I still have my comfort food. However, even that can be well presented with good ingredients, and we were not doing that. So a customer that I respected told me, kid, you are charming and wonderful, but you're not going to go very far. People pretty soon are going to go elsewhere. People pretty soon are going to say, oh, Valentino, what a terrible restaurant. And before you know, it's too late. So I went to Italy to learn myself what is a real restaurant. And that became a revelation because suddenly he takes me to a restaurant and they start talking about tartufi. I heard that there was a chocolate wrapped and it's called chocolate truffle, but he was talking about something else. I heard another word called carpaccio and I said, do you eat raw meat? And that was a quick drive. I better learn or I'm dead. And I literally accelerated so that I could research, see the difference, and find the chef.
And could you even, and this is something I think that Julia Child faced when she tried to bring French cooking to America, could you even find the ingredients that you needed to make the food as good as it's made in Italy in these places that you were going to?
Then was very difficult because we had to do our homework and pass it to the consumer. And one of the drama was that the consumer had to be educated. Here you are with one of the classic of Valentino, which is a southern Italian dish revisited completely. The ricotta, which is a cheese of the south, that has been dressed up by wonderful vegetables, and the flavors are given from one of the things that I introduced, which was old balsamic vinegar. And old balsamic vinegar is an art in itself. It's not the $3.95 in the shell of the supermarket, but something that is cured drop by drop, from barrel to barrel, from vintage to vintage, and so forth. But the flavor, as you can see, is what makes this dish.
I just want to point this out. Listeners, if you are using extra virgin olive oil, it's not an overstatement to say that Piero is the reason that you are doing it.
But it happened with an item that now you find in every supermarket in the world called radicchio. I wanted to have this red cabbage because it was completely different, because you can grill it, you can fry it, but mostly you can serve as a salad. The first time that I told my vegetable producer here in Los Angeles, I want to have this red thing called radicchio. He says, wow, I've never heard of it. So I said, see if you can find it. So he called me and he says, I got your radicchio. Oh, I say, send it over. He says, wait, the radicchio cost me $35 for the whole crate, and I would be very happy to charge you $35. But I got to charge you the freight, which is $175. So this was presenting and introducing things that were completely foreign. When I introduced buffalo mozzarella, which now is the most common thing that everybody knows, people start saying, there are buffalo in Italy? Oh, and you charge me $10 for cottage cheese re-fermented? What are you talking about? Slowly, Italian food, as I like to say, went to university.
You're also known for bringing Italian wines.
When I opened this restaurant in 72, California wines were less than mediocre, and so were Italian wines. Very, very mediocre wine. There was one called Lambrusco, which was nothing but bubbles.
Riuniti has the taste that goes great with all your favorite foods. A taste that makes Riuniti the world's best-loved imported wine.
But then there was the awakening. The awakening that happened in California and eventually spread it through the United States. In Italy, it was a little different because they already have all of these things. It was a matter of handpicked or find the next generation that kind of said, Papa, we got to throw away the old barrel. We got to throw away the overcrapping wines that you have been making forever and ever. And we got to make wines with more technology, with more finesse, with more intensity and character and so forth. And all of that happened in the 80s when suddenly we are receiving some incredible wines from Tuscany, from Piedmont, and so the famous Barolo, the famous Super Tuscan, the famous Brunello di Montalcino. And all of these things needed a showcase. And so I got excited and I personally was showcasing the best of the best. There is a sense of pride and looking at all of these things and kind of saying, I was there when nobody even knew. And that's been very exciting because it's been a food revolution that doesn't stop.
From your left, three milk cheese called Latour. The honey on top is from a lime tree. On the right, you have a pecorino.
Right now, fine dining is going through a crisis. People want casual, noisy. And dining is a big part of that other thing called hospitality. So when you embrace the two things, right now we are having a crisis, which I'm sure, especially in a city of this dimension, in a city of this sophistication, will eventually come back.
Piero, thank you so much for a delicious lunch and a great conversation.
Until next time.
All right, well, speaking of eating, if you haven't recovered from your holiday binge, we've got some good ways to spend your downtime, you know, as you're waiting for the food to digest and you can't move off the couch. Put on your sweatpants, kick back. We'll be back in a minute with The Binge, our regular feature on the best in streaming entertainment when Take Two returns. Labbro cari sì, io notte e giorno vengo qua. Sotto e sotto, papà su, ne vuoi tassiri, troppo un bollo. Nella mia castello mondo, sì davvero. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino in for A. Martinez. The holidays are about spending time with friends and family, but that shouldn't stop you from kicking back and relaxing. And what better way to do that than with A. Martinez and some binge-worthy streaming entertainment.
So you had to stream just one more episode? Are you kidding me? No!
Mark Jordan Legan is our guide. He's co-host of the podcast Film Freaks Forever. Hello, Mark.
Hey, great to see you.
All right, let's start with your first choice. You can find it on Netflix. Tell us about Maniac.
Yes, this is a 10-episode Netflix show that is a remake of a Norwegian series of the same name. Jonah Hill and Emma Stone play two very different people who take part in a new experimental drug trial at a cutting-edge facility. Now, this is a dark, unique show, and you have to give it some time, but it is filled with terrific performances and sharp, intelligent writing. It feels at times like David Lynch and Matt Groening trying to write for Hal the Computer in 2001 A Space Odyssey, and I mean that as a compliment.
Now, Sally Field, she almost steals this whole thing?
You know what? That is so true. And in fact, even though Emma Stone and Jonah Hill are their leads and they're really good in Maniac, I was fascinated by the relationship between the lead scientist and his famous mother, played by Justin Theroux, and Sally Field. Field is one of these talking head pop psychologists you see all over TV selling their self-help books. In this clip, we hear a co-worker of Theroux's suggest he may need his estranged mom's help with a current problem.
I know it's been 7 years, but you have to call your mother.
No! No, 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 no!
No, but your mother would have a unique understanding of the way...
No, my mother is a venomous, egotistical charlatan who deploys catchphrases and platitudes and therapies of the day in order to dupe millions of people out of their money and their happiness. No, my mother... sells happiness. She sells it that it crumbles in your hand the minute you're out of earshot of her magical thinking and her platitudes and her invented words and her primal yawps and her steps to success. No, I'm not bringing her here.
Justin Theroux plays unhinged well. He was in American Psycho as Patrick Bateman's friend in America. Yeah, he was unhinged there, too.
You know, it's interesting because, again, you know, he has been around for a long time. And to be honest, I've never actually been much of a fan of Justin Theroux's acting before, but I think he is just wonderful in this. In fact, in this next clip, Sally Field discovers that the main computer that her son has constructed to oversee this million-dollar drug study has been based on, well, let's give it a listen.
Let me just see if I understand this. So, 7 years ago, and shortly after you and your therapist mother stopped speaking, you decided to develop a sequence of drugs that would eliminate therapy altogether. But now your mother computer is sad, and so you had to call in your real mother to talk to her about her feelings. Is that all correct?
You know, Maniac might be a bit too different and offbeat for some, but it is very funny, very moving look at broken people and broken machines trying to fix themselves.
How anyone could not like Sally Field. I mean, really, really like Sally Field.
Yes.
I mean, you just don't have a heart.
She hits it out of the park in this one.
All right, now to your second pick, and I've seen this one. This is Amazon Prime's Jack Ryan. Tell us about Jack Ryan.
Yes, you know, I have to give John Krasinski major credit. You know, where many actors might be forever pigeonholed by playing such a popular, beloved character like Jim in The Office, he has really reinvented himself, first by co-writing, directing, and starring in this summer's horror film hit, A Quiet Place.
A good movie, yeah.
Yes, and now by taking on Tom Clancy's famous character, Jack Ryan.
Now, he's not the first to play Jack Ryan. Who else has taken this role?
Yeah, believe it or not, he is the fifth.
Wow.
Let's recap quickly. Okay. Harrison Ford, Alec Baldwin, Ben Affleck, Chris Pine, and now Mr. Krasinski. You know, and I have to say, it took a little bit of arm twisting to get me to sample this show, but once I started, I was hooked. First of all, don't you agree? It's very bingeable.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, they end each episode, you want to keep going.
This is one of those shows where just cut out a block of the day because you're not going to be able to do much of anything else.
Right, because it's so compelling. Yeah. It's full of great action sequences. But the interesting thing about the Ryan character is that, you know, he starts as a desk jockey, a brilliant desk jockey. But as he gets more involved, his military background comes in handy. Here, Ryan is overseas, tracking down a terrorist, and after seeing him in action, a French officer approaches.
Can I ask you something? How could you be in the CIA, knowing everything your government does?
Well, I figure it's better to be on the inside. Maybe be able to change something and be on the outside and not be able to change anything.
What do you do for them?
I'm an analyst.
For a guy who works behind a desk, you seem to like the feel. I think you have everyone fooled. I think you are a wolf who plays at being a sheep.
The great thing about the Jack Ryan character is that throughout a lot of the different incarnations, and even in this one, Jack Ryan thinks he's an analyst. While everything's heightening around him, I'm still an analyst. No, you're not. You're kind of a badass. In
yes,
a way. Yeah.
Yes, a badass.
Different
analyst.
Than Jim Halpern's office too. Yeah,
very much so. So yeah, this 8-episode season is exhilarating with well-drawn characters and a nice mix of action and suspense.
All right, third choice is the latest from the Coen brothers. Tell us about The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Yeah, you know, this is an unusual film. First of all, it's an anthology with 6 different stories all set in the Old West. And like many of their other films, the Coens are able to wring humor and satire from the darkest of sources. Now, everyone from James Franco to Tom Waits to Zoe Kazan appear in The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. And as with any anthology, you're going to have some chapters that work better than others. But overall, it really does work, and it really packs quite the existential punch. Now, some segments have a blend of the wild comedy of their earlier films, like Raising Arizona, and others carry a serious and bleak tone, like A Serious Man. Now, in the first segment, Tim Blake Nelson is great as a guitar-playing, singing cowboy who stops in a remote saloon for a drink, but is instantly mocked by the filthy, dangerous outlaws who inhabit the place.
Well, don't let my white duds and pleasant demeanor fool you. I, too, have been known to violate the statutes of man, and not a few of the laws of the Almighty.
You ain't no outlaw, and we don't drink with tin horns.
Sir, it seems that you are no better a judge of human beings than you are a specimen of one. Just on a brief inventory, I'd say that you could use yourself a shave and a brighter disposition. And lastly, if you don't mind me aspersing your friends, a better class of drinking buddy.
It seems like a Coen Brothers trademark, right? To ping pong between humor and violence.
Oh,
like that, right?
Absolutely. And the first chapter, Buster Scruggs, certainly does that. You know, I personally loved the Tom Waits story as a prospector and the one with Zoe Kazan as a young pioneer woman just trying to make it west in a wagon train. But The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is full of wonderful performances, and the Coen Brothers once again deliver entertaining tales where mortality is often a punchline, and yet you find yourself laughing in spite of it all.
That's Mark Jordan Ligon, co-host of the podcast Film Freaks Forever, bringing us some of his end-of-the-year binge-worthy picks. Mark, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And that was A. Martinez with Mark Jordan Ligon. And that will be our last edition of The Binge on Take 2. A big thank you to Mark for always bringing us his choice picks. If you find yourself in need of some stimulating binge-worthy picks in the future, you can always follow Mark on Twitter. He's at MJ Ligon. Coming up next on KPCC, we've got Air Talk, and Frank Stoltz is sitting in Larry Mantle's chair today, giving him some holiday time off. Frank, what are you going to be talking about today?
There's been a new development in one of the most closely watched cases involving a California death row inmate. On Christmas Eve, Governor Brown ordered new DNA testing on evidence in the case of Kevin Cooper, who says he did not murder 4 people in Chino Hills in 1983. We'll take a look at that case. Federal criminal justice reform is finally here. It's modest, though, compared to what California has done over the past few years. Still, hundreds of people may be getting out of federal prison early as a result. And in the second hour, it's all about pot. It's been 1 year since the state legalized it. Pot tax revenue was supposed to be a windfall. It really hasn't been.
All right. Air Talk is next. Take 2 returns tomorrow.